Hello, this is Miles, and you're tuned in to Behind the Scams. In today's episode, Nick and Sue take a close look at how modern crypto and investment scams are really operating, and why they've become increasingly dangerous. This episode breaks down how these schemes work from start to finish, from the first contact and trust building, to the manipulation that happens long before money is ever involved. Nick and Sue explain how many of these scams are now run through organized scam farms, using scripts, teams, and structured processes to guide victims step by step. They also cover what happens once money moves into the crypto ecosystem, why it disappears so quickly, and why recovery is so difficult. Understanding how these scams work is one of the most effective ways to reduce risk and protect yourself. Let's get into it.
Welcome to Behind the Scams, the podcast where we pull back the curtain on the frauds and schemes that are making headlines and, unfortunately, emptying bank accounts. I'm Nick, and today we're diving into an operation that is massive in scope, technologically sophisticated, and absolutely devastating to its targets.
It's great to be here, Nick, and you aren't exaggerating. When you look at the data, we aren't just talking about a few bad actors. We are talking about a literal machine for stealing money.
That is exactly what it is. In 2024, the FBI's Internet Crime Complaint Center recorded a staggering $16.6 billion in total reported losses. That's a 33% increase from the previous year.
$16.6 billion. It's a number that's hard to even process, and a huge portion of that is tied directly to the world of digital assets, right?
Exactly. While cryptocurrency-related complaints only represent about 10% of total fraud reports, they now account for nearly 50% of all reported losses. The primary engine behind this is cryptocurrency investment fraud, which saw losses skyrocket to $5.8 billion in 2024, a 47% increase in just 1 year. To understand how we got here, we have to step back and look at the bigger picture, because what we're dealing with today didn't appear overnight. This didn't start with crypto. Crypto didn't create fraud. What it did was change the scale, the speed, and the economics of crime in a way we've never seen before.
And I think that's an important distinction. Fraud has always existed. There have always been con artists. But this feels different. It feels industrial.
Exactly. Historically, fraud was limited by geography and friction. A scammer needed to be physically near their victim, or at least in the same country. They had to deal with banks, postal systems, borders, and law enforcement jurisdictions that slowed them down. Every step added friction. Every transaction increased risk.
There were natural choke points.
Right. Credit card fraud could be reversed. Wire fraud raised red flags at banks. Cash required physical movement, and even large telemarketing scams required infrastructure that was expensive and relatively easy to disrupt.
So fraud scaled, but only to a point.
Crypto removed many of those constraints at once. It allowed criminals to move value instantly across borders, without relying on traditional financial intermediaries. There's no bank manager to question a transaction, no teller who recognizes that something feels off, no automatic pause while someone double-checks a transfer.
And no clear point where someone says, wait, this doesn't make sense.
Exactly. From the criminal's perspective, crypto solved three core problems: speed, reach, and deniability. Speed means funds can be moved in minutes instead of days. Reach means a scammer in Southeast Asia can target a retiree in Arizona as easily as someone next door. And deniability comes from the fact that transactions are pseudonymous. You see the money move, but you don't see the human behind it.
That anonymity creates emotional distance, too. It's easier to steal from someone you never have to face.
It does, and it changed the risk calculus for organized crime. Suddenly, fraud wasn't a side hustle. It became one of the highest margin criminal enterprises in the world. Lower risk than drug trafficking, higher returns than traditional cybercrime, and far fewer consequences, at least initially.
That explains why we're seeing these massive coordinated operations, instead of lone scammers working out of a basement.
Precisely. Organized crime groups are rational actors. They follow incentives. when they saw that crypto-enabled fraud could generate billions of dollars with relatively low arrest rates, they invested heavily. They professionalized. They standardized scripts. They created training pipelines.
Almost like a franchise model.
That's not an exaggeration. Some of these networks operate exactly like franchises. Recruiters bring in workers, managers oversee quotas, technical teams maintain infrastructure, launderers handle cash out, and leadership sits several layers removed from the actual victim contact.
And all of this happened quietly, while most of the public still thought of crypto scams as niche or technical.
That's an important point. Public perception lagged behind reality. For years, many people thought crypto fraud only affected tech-savvy investors or early adopters. But by the time awareness caught up, these networks had already scaled globally.
Which brings us to the international dimension. This isn't just a U.S. problem.
Not even close. Victims are spread across North America, Europe, Australia, and increasingly parts of Africa and South America. The infrastructure, meanwhile, is often concentrated in regions with weak governance, corruption, or ongoing conflict.
And that creates a perfect storm.
It does. These syndicates exploit disparities between countries. Strong consumer protections in one nation don't matter if the scammer, the server, and the money trail all exist elsewhere. Law enforcement cooperation takes time. Criminals move faster.
So by the time one country reacts, the operation has already shifted.
Exactly. That's why we see the same playbooks reused over and over. Wrong number techs, fake investment platforms, romance angles. The tactics persist because they work and because shutting them down completely requires coordination that's incredibly difficult to sustain.
And for victims, that global scale makes everything feel overwhelming. You don't just feel tricked, you feel powerless.
That sense of powerlessness is a feature of the system, not a bug. The machine is designed to make victims feel isolated, confused, and unsure where to turn. And when you zoom out, you realize this isn't just a story about technology. It's a story about globalization, inequality, and how criminal organizations adapt faster than the systems meant to stop them.
Which is why understanding the scale matters. Because once you see this as a global machine, not a series of isolated scams, the rest of the story starts to make sense.
Exactly. And now that we understand how this became possible, we can take a closer look at how the most notorious of these schemes, pig butchering, actually operates on the ground.
So it's an industrial-scale operation. These syndicates are essentially operating like multinational corporations with their own versions of HR departments and call centers.
They are. And the most prevalent form of this is a scheme with a particularly chilling name, pig butchering, or Sha Zhu Pan. It originated in China, but has now spread globally, with massive operations housed in sprawling, heavily guarded compounds in Southeast Asia, specifically countries like Cambodia, Laos, and Myanmar. When we talk about pig butchering operations, it's important to understand that these aren't just chat rooms or laptops scattered across a city. Many of these scams are run out of physical compounds, large, fortified facilities that look more like factories or prisons than offices.
And the people inside them aren't always criminals by choice.
Exactly. A significant number of the people sending those messages were trafficked into these compounds. They were recruited through fake job ads, promising work in IT, customer service, marketing, or crypto support. The ads often look legitimate, complete with interviews, contracts, and travel arrangements.
So from the outside, it looks like a real job opportunity.
Right. Once they arrived, often in another country, the situation changes immediately. Passports are confiscated, phones are taken, movement is restricted. Armed guards control the perimeter. At that point, the job offer turns into captivity.
Survivors have described it as realizing all at once that there's no way out.
Inside these compounds, the workday is relentless. Workers are typically forced to operate in shifts that last 12 to 16 hours a day, sometimes longer. They sit at rows of computers, often dozens or hundreds at a time, all running multiple scam conversations simultaneously.
Almost like a call center, but built around fraud.
That's exactly how it's structured. There are supervisors walking the floor, there are performance metrics, and there are quotas. Each worker may be required to initiate contact with dozens of potential victims per day and convert a certain number into active relationships.
And if they don't meet those quotas?
Punishment is routine and severe. Survivors have reported beatings, electric shocks, starvation, confinement, and public humiliation. In some compounds, punishment is deliberately inflicted in front of others to reinforce fear and compliance.
So violence becomes part of the management strategy.
It does. This is forced labor, plain and simple. The violence isn't random. It's systematic. It's designed to extract maximum productivity while breaking down resistance.
Which adds another layer of tragedy to this, because the victim on the other end of the screen has no idea that the person they're talking to may also be a victim.
That's right. And the structure inside these compounds reinforces emotional detachment. Workers are trained using scripts that tell them exactly what to say at each stage of the scam, how to introduce themselves, how to pivot conversations toward trust, how to escalate toward investment.
So even empathy is industrialized.
It is. Some compounds even have internal training academies. New arrivals are taught psychological manipulation techniques, cultural norms of different target countries, and how to spot emotional vulnerabilities quickly.
They're trained to identify loneliness, grief, financial anxiety.
Precisely, and they're monitored constantly. Conversations are reviewed, successful scripts are shared, failed approaches are corrected. This is not improvisation, it's optimization.
It's chilling to hear how refined this has become.
Another key detail is debt bondage. Many trafficked workers are told they owe tens of thousands of dollars for travel, housing, or training. That debt becomes the justification for continued captivity. They're told they can leave once it's paid off, but the debt is structured so it never is.
So even the illusion of escape is manipulated.
Yes, and in some cases, workers are sold or transferred between compounds like commodities if they're underperforming. The human cost is staggering.
And yet, from the outside, all the victim sees is a friendly message, a kind voice, maybe even a video call.
That contrast is one of the most disturbing aspects of this system. On one side of the screen, you have a retiree slowly losing their life savings. On the other side, you may have a trafficked worker under threat of violence if they don't keep the conversation going.
It really reframes what we mean when we say scammer.
It does. There are absolutely criminals at the top of these organizations, people who profit enormously and orchestrate everything. But the people doing the daily outreach are often trapped in a system designed to exploit everyone except the people at the very top.
And that's why shutting these operations down is so complicated.
Exactly. You're not just dealing with cybercrime. You're dealing with organized crime, human trafficking, corruption, and cross-border enforcement challenges all at once. These compounds exist because local authorities may be overwhelmed, under-resourced, or compromised.
Which means even when they're exposed, they don't always disappear.
Right. Some are raided and reopened under new management. Others relocate across borders. The infrastructure, the scripts, the platforms, the laundering channels can be packed up and moved quickly.
So the physical compounds are just one piece of a much larger machine.
They are. But understanding what happens inside them helps explain why these scams are so persistent, so emotionally manipulative, and so devastating. They are powered by fear, coercion, and industrial-scale exploitation.
And that context matters, because it shows this isn't just about bad decisions or careless victims. It's about a global system designed to extract money at enormous human cost.
Exactly. And now that we understand the environment these scams are coming from, we can take a closer look at how victims are pulled in step by step, and why even highly intelligent people fall for it.
This is the part that is so hard to hear. The people sending those charming messages aren't always the masterminds. Often, they are victims themselves who have been trafficked into these labor camps.
That's a critical point. Many are lured by fake job postings for tech or customer support roles. Once they arrive, their passports are confiscated and they're forced into debt bondage. They work 12 to 16-hour days under the threat of being beaten, electrocuted, or starved if they don't meet their quotas for finding new victims.
It's a tragedy on both sides of the screen. One person is being financially destroyed, while the person on the other end is being physically tortured. It really highlights that this isn't just cybercrime. It's a massive human trafficking crisis running in parallel with the financial scam.
Precisely. These compounds function like scam factories. They don't just wing it. They use highly professional crime-as-a-service models. They buy pre-written scripts, specialized translation software, and even technical support from developers who build the fake trading platform.
Nick, looking at the scale of these compounds, it feels less like a gang and more like a shadow industry. How are they structured to operate so successfully across so many borders?
It's because they function as true organized criminal enterprises. These aren't loose collections of hackers. They are hierarchical syndicates that contract out specialized services. You have the C-suite level administrators who manage the infrastructure, the affiliates who execute the actual attacks or scams, and the professional money launderers who move the proceeds across the globe.
So why can't we just find these headquarters and shut them down? If we know they're in specific compounds in Myanmar or Cambodia, what's the holdup?
That's the core of the problem: jurisdiction and regulatory arbitrage. These groups deliberately set up shop in weak enforcement zones, regions with significant political instability or where the central government has little to no control. It's a calculated move. They essentially shop for the most favorable legal environment to commit crimes, moving their infrastructure to whichever country has the laxest anti-money laundering law.
It sounds like they're playing a global game of chess, and they're always three moves ahead of the local laws.
Exactly. They even set up complex webs of shell companies across multiple jurisdictions, like the Seychelles or the Marshall Islands, to make company formation non-transparent. A syndicate might be headquartered in one country, subject to the laws of another, and have its servers in a third country that utilizes bulletproof hosting. These hosting providers are notorious because they essentially grant leniency on content and frequently refuse to respond to any lawful request for information from international police.
So even if the FBI identifies a server or a leader, they have to navigate a diplomat's nightmare just to get one piece of evidence.
Precisely. This legal and regulatory friction is what keeps the machine running. Law enforcement must work through local agencies, which can be slow, difficult, and sometimes even compromised by the syndicates who pay bribes to operate with local impunity.
So they're following a literal step-by-step playbook to reel people in?
Exactly. Step one is the unsolicited contact. It's often the wrong number trick. A text like, "Is this the yoga instructor?" If you reply, the AI-enhanced botnets or the trafficked workers begin the grooming. They are looking for specific emotional vulnerabilities: loneliness, recent divorce, or financial distress due to an ill family member.
And they don't mention money for a long time. They just become a friend.
Correct. This is where we see love bombing and emotional conditioning. The goal isn't just to talk. It's to create a biochemical dependency. By providing constant attention, validation, and a sense of exclusive connection, they flood the victim's brain with dopamine and oxytocin. Scammers build rapport for weeks or months using text messages, video chats, and phone calls to endear themselves to the target. It's not just a conversation. It's a masterclass in psychological manipulation designed to bypass rational thought entirely. At this point, it's important to slow everything down and walk through what actually happens to the money step by step, from the moment a victim decides to invest. Because this is where many people assume there must be a safeguard or a checkpoint, and there usually isn't.
And I think this is where listeners say, surely someone would stop this.
That's the assumption. So let's start at the moment of decision. The victim believes they're making an investment. They're not trying to hide anything. They go to their own bank. They may even talk to a teller or log into their retirement account.
so everything looks normal at first.
Exactly. The victim transfers funds from a checking account, savings account, or retirement account into a legitimate cryptocurrency exchange. Coinbase, Kraken, Gemini, these are real companies, and the transaction itself is legitimate.
That step alone lowers suspicion.
Completely. From the victim's perspective, they haven't sent money to a stranger. They've bought an asset, Bitcoin, Ethereum, Tether, something they recognize by name.
And then comes the critical step.
Right. The scanner provides a wallet address or a QR code and instructs the victim to move the funds to the trading platform. This is the moment the money leaves the regulated financial system.
Once it's sent, there's no undo button.
Exactly. Crypto transactions are irreversible. There's no fraud department to call, no chargeback. The blockchain simply records that the funds moved from one address to another.
And the victim often doesn't realize that yet.
No, they believe their money is now in the system, earning profits. In reality, the funds have already been received by the criminal network.
And they don't sit still.
Not for a second. Almost immediately, the funds are broken up and moved. One transaction becomes dozens. Dozens become hundreds. This is where wallet hopping and peeling chains begin.
So by the time anyone looks, the trail has already splintered.
Exactly. And while that's happening, the victim is still logging into the fake platform, watching numbers go up, believing everything is fine.
Which is devastating in hindsight.
It is, because the platform isn't holding money at all. It's a simulation. The profits aren't real. They're just numbers on a screen.
And eventually, the victim tries to withdraw.
That's when the illusion collapses. The platform suddenly flags the account. There's a tax requirement, a liquidity fee, a compliance issue, something that must be paid before funds can be released.
And it sounds official.
Very official. It's designed to sound routine. And because the victim already believes the money exists, paying the fee feels logical. I'm just unlocking what's mine.
But the moment that fee is paid,
the money is gone as well. It follows the same path as the original funds. And if the victim refuses to pay, communication stops.
That's the moment many victims finally realize what's happened.
Yes. And by then, the funds have often crossed multiple blockchains, passed through mixers, and reach exchanges or cash-out points in jurisdictions that don't cooperate with U.S. law enforcement.
Which explains why recovery is so rare.
Exactly. It's not because no one cares, it's because the system was designed to move faster than any response. By the time a report is filed, the money has already been laundered.
And that's when desperation sets in.
Right. Victims start searching for help. And unfortunately, that's when recovery scammers often strike, promising to undo the damage for a fee.
Which leads us into a whole other layer of risk.
It does. But the key takeaway here is this. There is no single moment where the scam fails. Every step feels reasonable at the time. That's why so many intelligent, cautious people get caught in it.
And why understanding the process matters, because it replaces shame with clarity.
Exactly. And with that clarity, people are far more likely to report, seek legitimate help, and protect others from the same fate.
It sounds like they are rewiring the victim's brain to see the scammer as the primary source of comfort. We often assume intelligent, cautious people would spot a lie, but you cannot spot a biochemical reaction you aren't even aware is happening.
That's why these schemes work on doctors, lawyers, and engineers alike. Once the emotional floor is laid, they leverage authority bias and perceived expertise. The scammer adopts a fictitious identity, perhaps a successful architect or business owner, who projects a lavish lifestyle funded by crypto. They don't just claim to be rich, they claim to have a mentor, often a supposed financial genius uncle, who provides inside information. This creates a situation where the victim feels they would be foolish not to listen, as the scammer silences the victim's internal alarm bells through this perceived authority.
So the victim is conditioned to believe they are part of an exclusive secret world.
Exactly. That leads to step three. The onboarding. They don't just take your money directly. They coach you through the process, instructing you to go to a legitimate, reputable exchange like Coinbase to buy your first batch of Bitcoin or Tether. This makes the process feel safe because you're using a real bank and a real exchange.
But then the pivot happens, and they move those funds off the safe exchange.
Exactly. They provide a link to a proprietary app or a fraudulent trading platform. These websites are incredibly sophisticated simulations that mimic authentic platforms with real-time market data. When the victim invests, the scammer simply types numbers into the backend to show the balance growing.
And this is where they use intermittent reinforcement, right?
Right. They allow the victim to withdraw small amounts of money early in the scam. They might say, "Your $5,000 is now $7,000. Take some out for a nice dinner." When that money actually hits the victim's bank account, it serves as proof of concept. The brain records a successful withdrawal, which makes the risk of a much larger investment seem negligible.
It uses the victim's own logic against them. If I can take money out, it can't be a scam. But while they build that trust, they're also working to isolate the victim.
Isolation is key to preventing outside intervention. Scammers tell victims, "Your family won't understand our connection," or "Don't tell your friends, they'll get jealous and try to sabotage you." They deliberately drive a wedge between the victim and their natural support system. By the time a family member notices a 401k is being emptied, the victim has been conditioned to see that family member as a threat to their future happiness.
It leaves the victim in an echo chamber of deception. And that leads to the sunk cost fallacy, doesn't it?
Precisely. As the victim pours in life savings or takes out home equity loans, their commitment escalates. Scammers push for even larger sums for a once-in-a-lifetime market event. Because the victim has invested so much time, emotion, and money, they feel they must continue to see the payoff. The fear of losing what they've already committed overrides the fear of losing more.
And then the trap snaps shut.
Step 6, the slaughter. When the victim eventually tries to fully withdraw their investment, the platform demands a fraudulent tax or fee. Even if the victim pays, the criminals never release the funds.
The person you've talked to every day for months just vanishes.
Poof, their profiles are deleted and their numbers are disconnected. This brings us to the final psychological weapon: shame and embarrassment. In 2024, the FBI's IC3 referred 42 victims specifically for suicide intervention, because the toll of this betrayal is so catastrophic. Many victims feel such profound shame that they delay reporting or never report at all. They blame themselves, which is exactly what the scammers count on to keep the machine running.
And we know that only a fraction of these crimes are even reported because of this.
Conservatively, yes. Research indicates that only about 4.8% of mass market fraud victims ever report to a government entity or a Better Business Bureau. Depending on the methodology, the true cost of fraud to older adults in 2024 alone could be as high as $81.5 billion.
I've noticed the reports mention Bitcoin ATMs or kiosks specifically for this demographic. Why is that such a common tool?
Because it's an easy way to move cash into the digital world with more anonymity than a traditional bank. Scammers provide QR codes and coach victims to withdraw cash from their retirement accounts and deposit it into these kiosks. In 2023 alone, the IC3 received over 5,500 complaints regarding crypto kiosks, with losses exceeding $189 million.
It really does feel like a game of whack-a-mole where the moles have jetpacks. And once that money is in the crypto ecosystem, it's incredibly hard to track because of how the machine launders it. Nick, let's slow down here. Can you walk us through what happens the very second a victim hits send on that crypto transfer?
Of course. The moment a victim sends those funds, they enter a world designed to make them vanish. You have to remember that while the blockchain is a public ledger, it's also essentially a glass bank. Everyone can see the money moving from one vault to another, but they can't see the names on the accounts.
Wait, so if it's a glass bank and everyone can see it, why can't the police just follow it to the person holding the bag?
Because the person is just a string of letters and numbers called a wallet address. The second those funds hit the scammer's address, they don't sit still. They are often moved immediately to an account overseas for cash out purposes. This first step is where they use a technique called wallet hopping or peeling chains.
peeling chains. That sounds like something out of a spy novel. What does that actually mean in plain English?
Think of it like a traveler who has a single $1,000 bill. They know that a big bill is easy to track, so they walk into a busy train station and swap it for 10 $100 bills. Then they go to 10 different kiosks and swap each of those for 10 $10 bills. On the blockchain, a launderer takes a large amount of stolen crypto and repeatedly distributes it into brand new single-use addresses in very small amounts.
So what that means is instead of one big trail to follow, the investigator is suddenly looking at hundreds of tiny separate paths.
Exactly. They peel off a small amount to an exchange to cash out and send the rest to a new address, repeating the process dozens of times. This makes it incredibly difficult for an exchange to realize that 100 small deposits are actually coming from the same stolen pot. And while they're peeling these chains, they are also chain hopping.
Okay, chain hopping, I'm assuming that's not jumping between actual metal chains. Is that moving between different types of crypto?
Precisely. It's swapping from one blockchain, like Bitcoin, to another, like Ethereum. They do this to break the transaction trail completely. It's like a criminal driving a car to the state line, then ditching it and getting on a boat, then a plane. Each time they switch vehicles or blockchains, the investigators have to find a new way to pick up the scent.
And they're using stablecoins for this, right? You mentioned Tether or USDT earlier.
Yes. Launderers love stablecoins, specifically Tether or USDT on the Tron network. Crypto can be very volatile. The price swings wildly. If you're a criminal laundering $5 million, you don't want the value to drop by half while you're moving it. Stablecoins are pegged to the US dollar, so the value stays steady. It provides a safe harbor for their illicit funds while they figure out the next step.
So it's like a waiting room for stolen money, where the value won't disappear. But eventually, they have to hide the source of those funds. Is that where the mixers and tumblers come in?
That is exactly where they come in. A mixer, or tumbler, is a service that takes your dirty crypto and blends it with thousands of other users' coins. Imagine a crowded fountain where everyone throws their coins into the water at the same time. After a few minutes, everyone reaches in and takes out the exact amount they threw in. You still have your $5, but you don't have the same 5 coins you started with. You have someone else's.
So the serial numbers are gone. The connection between the victim's wallet and the final destination is totally broken.
Right. Mixers like Tornado Cash or Sinbad have been used to launder billions, including funds stolen by North Korean state-sponsored hackers. FinCEN has officially designated crypto mixing as a class of transactions of primary money laundering concern because its main purpose is to break that traceability.
This sounds like it takes a lot of technical skill. Is the average scammer doing this themselves?
Often they don't have to. We are seeing a rise in crime as a service. Professional money launderers sell KYC kits on the dark web. These kits include stolen identity documents, utility bills, and even selfies of real people. Scammers use these to open accounts at legitimate exchanges under someone else's name.
So they're using mule accounts. They're basically wearing a digital mask using a real person's stolen life.
Exactly. They even recruit students or people looking for work from home jobs to act as money mules, often without those people realizing they are part of a crime. The mules use their own bank accounts to receive business transfers and then convert them to crypto for the scammers.
It's a layered defense. Nick, you said earlier that tracing is sometimes possible, yet recovery is still rare. If the bank is glass and we have these tools, why is it so hard to get the money back?
This is the most frustrating part for victims. Even if a forensic firm like Elliptic or Chainalysis traces the funds to an exchange, that exchange might be in a high-risk jurisdiction like Russia or a region with no AML laws. These exchanges often refuse to cooperate with U.S. law enforcement. By the time a legal order is issued, the money has already been moved again or withdrawn as cash at a crypto ATM.
Meanwhile, the syndicates are getting even more professional, using crime-as-a-service models.
Right. They can buy KYC kits on the dark web, stolen IDs and selfies that they use to open accounts at legitimate exchanges to cash out. They're even using AI to generate scripts and potentially deepfakes to impersonate people during video calls.
This is what makes the public so frustrated. We hear about millions of dollars in losses, we see the addresses on the blockchain, and yet these syndicates keep operating. Is there a reason why takedowns and arrests always seem to lag behind the scams?
It's the systemic lag. Law enforcement must follow due process, which often involves months of forensic tracing followed by complex international warrants. Meanwhile, these syndicates are incredibly agile. If one mixer is taken down, like Blender.io, they immediately pivot to another, like Sinbad. By the time a court makes a ruling on one technology, the criminals have already moved to the next one.
And we've seen how even the legal attempts to curb this are met with challenges in the courts.
Right. In November 2024, the U.S. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that the Treasury Department exceeded its authority when it sanctioned Tornado Cash in 2022. The court concluded that its immutable smart contracts are technology, not property subject to sanctions. While this was a victory for privacy advocates, it creates an even greater hurdle for regulators who are trying to cut off the flow of stolen funds.
So if the technology itself can't be sanctioned and the hosting is in a non-cooperative country, how do we stop the machine?
Global coordination is difficult, but it is the only way forward. We are starting to see it work. Operation Elaborate, which took down the iSpoof platform, involved 10 different countries coordinating their arrests simultaneously. Operation Emma 8 resulted in over 2,400 arrests of money mules worldwide. The reality is that no single country can solve this because the evidence is scattered across 100 different borders. It requires constant, real-time sharing of data between the public and private sector.
The human cost of all this is just catastrophic. Beyond the billions lost, the IC3's Operation Level Up had to refer 42 victims to specialists for suicide intervention in 2024 alone. The shame and isolation these victims feel is a key part of the scammer strategy.
It is, but law enforcement is making progress. The FBI's Recovery Asset Team, or RAT, uses the financial fraud kill chain to freeze funds if they are reported immediately. In 2024, they initiated over 3,000 requests and successfully froze over $561 million.
And we just saw that massive DOJ civil forfeiture in June 2025, right?
Yes, the DOJ filed a complaint against $225.3 million in cryptocurrency. It was the largest crypto seizure in the history of the U.S. Secret Service, and it was linked directly to these investment fraud networks.
That's a hopeful sign, but we also need to talk about what happens after someone realizes they've been hit, because there's a whole other layer to this machine, crypto recovery scams.
This is a vital topic, Sue. Many victims are targeted a second time by secondary scams, claiming they can recover their stolen funds. It's essentially double victimization.
It's so predatory. These scammers monitor fraud forums or buy victim lists on the dark web. We have to be very clear with our listeners. You should be extremely suspicious of any unsolicited outreach from anyone claiming they can recover your crypto.
Absolutely. There are very specific red flags to watch for. First, that cold outreach on social media or Telegram is a dead giveaway. Second, look out for any guarantees of recovery. Because crypto transactions are generally irrevocable, no one can promise you'll get your money back.
And the biggest red flag is the request for an upfront fee. They might call it a retainer, a consulting fee, or even a tax to release the funds. Real agencies don't operate that way.
Exactly. They may even impersonate law enforcement, regulators, or investigators. Scammers have even spoofed the official FBI IC3 website to trick victims into sharing more data. It's important to know that the FBI does not work with third-party, non-law enforcement organizations to recover funds. They will never refer you to a private business or ask you for money to help.
Now, we should state that legitimate, experienced crypto recovery professionals do exist, but victims have to exercise extreme caution and verify every credential.
Yes, they do. And for consumer education, it can be helpful to look at factual examples of what a high-level professional profile looks like in this field, without focusing on any specific company or individual. Legitimate crypto recovery consultants typically come from backgrounds in financial crimes analysis, blockchain forensics, or complex fraud investigations, and they focus on tracing transactions, documenting evidence, and coordinating with attorneys or law enforcement, rather than promising guaranteed outcomes. If any of our listeners want additional context on what legitimate credentials and crypto recovery actually look like, or need a vetted resource for recovery-related purposes, you can reach out to us directly at info@stampoutscams.org. I work with a highly qualified professional in the crypto recovery space who possesses real credentials and hands-on expertise in blockchain analysis and fraud recovery, not an opportunistic scammer, and who can provide an honest, realistic evaluation of your situation and assist with recovery efforts where appropriate. For listeners who contact us through Stampout Scams, he has agreed to extend special incentives when introductions are made through our organization.
Yes, I know exactly who you're referring to, and he does have exactly the kind of verifiable background and specialized training consumers should look for when vetting an investigator. He really is the benchmark for crypto recovery expertise, not some cheap ad you might see on Facebook. Nick, recovery is always a complex legal and technical challenge, isn't it?
That's right, Sue. It really is. And there certainly are a lot of scammers advertising
on Facebook. You've been listening to Behind the Scams.
The gentleman I am referring to has well-documented credentials and expertise in the field of crypto recovery. Nick and Sue explained how today's crypto and investment scams operate as complete systems designed to exploit human behavior over time. The best path to start with is reporting at ic3.gov immediately.
That these scams
this not only helps you document
the
scam, but is instrumental in exposing
the tactics are deliberate,
as well as helping law
organized.
Enforcement track them down.
Secrecy
education
is
and
a
awareness remain the
friend.
Strongest
Breaking
defenses.
The silence is the only way to stop the
warning
machine.
Signs like
if
urgency,
an opportunity sounds
secrecy,
too good to be true,
and guarantees
always is.
Should
Think
always
of these
prompt
syndicates
caution.
As an industrial-scale
For
money
more episodes
laundry,
and resources,
your payment is a
visit
drop
behind
of water in a vast swirling reservoir.
You can
Once
also
it's
find
mixed in,
Behind the Scams on all major
drop
podcast
again
platforms.
Is nearly impossible.
Thank you
Stay
for listening.
Yes,
and we'll
good
see you next
time advice.
On Behind the Scams.
Thank you for breaking this down as well, Nick. Stories like this remind us that scams don't succeed because people are careless. They succeed because they're designed to exploit trust, emotion, and silence. If you take one thing away from this episode, let it be this. Slow down, question urgency, and talk to someone you trust before taking action. And if you or someone you know has been impacted, don't carry it alone. Reporting and speaking up matters. Join us next time on Behind the Scams as we continue to pull back the curtain, share what's really happening behind the scenes, and help people protect themselves and each other. Don't forget to visit the rest of SOS Media by going to stampoutscams.org and scamtv.org. This is Sue saying bye for now.
You've been listening to Behind the Scams. In this episode, Nick and Sue explained how today's crypto and investment scams operate as complete systems designed to exploit human behavior over time. One key takeaway is that these scams succeed not because people are careless, but because the tactics are deliberate and highly organized. Education and awareness remain the strongest defenses. Warning signs like urgency, secrecy, and guarantees should always prompt caution. For more episodes and resources, visit behindthescams.org. You can also find Behind the Scams on all major podcast platforms. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time on Behind the Scams.